Thank you. I really appreciate being here. And there are many events happening in today's world, which I'm sure you're all aware of, which have, in a sense, accelerated my interest in trying to project the ideas that I'm hoping to introduce you today. When I use the words, the world in transition, approaching the evolutionary event horizon, I mean those words very precisely as spoken, because we are approaching a kind of an event horizon. An event horizon meaning a transitional threshold that's irreversible. Once you've crossed to a certain extent and you get pulled towards where the next rail is going to be, we're at that edge. And so I'm going to try to describe the world that I see in this context, because much of my role is advising government officials, corporate entities, people in other think tanks who are now struggling to understand what is the future going to look like? How are we going to deal with this economically, technology, anthropologically? And there's a sense of urgency. And from my perspective, I look at the world as being very fragile. Many different sort of conflicting processes are going on. And this is before 9/11. And so it's like the ramp has suddenly gone almost vertical. So I'm going to try to integrate these realms today. But first of all, I'd like to show a video, if I may. And this video was done about 2 years ago. It was shown at SIGGRAPH. It's been shown on PBS television. And it's kind of like a snapshot of how things like nanotechnology, biotechnology, consciousness, and a global communication infrastructure sort of fit together as a framework. So perhaps we'll start with that, and we'll kind of use it as a platform to go further. So whenever the video appears, thanks a lot. This was a production that myself and about 35 other people worked on for 9 months. I used to teach at the Academy of Art College. Another part of my life is I did a lot of computer graphic work. So this is like an example of how to communicate these concepts in a visual, experiential way. No, we're looking at the computer, and I think we don't have the video. Sorry. Speaking of technology.
Nanotechnology.
We don't quite have empathic linkage to our systems quite yet, but we might someday.
Nanotechnology is the enterprise of assembling objects at the atomic scale. Using nanotechnology,
we have the blue screen of non-existence
for healing. The year is 2010 in Berlin. This is Sabrina. Sabrina's neurological disorder causes electrical shorts and misfirings between her nerve cells. We created tiny robots called nanites to patrol her body and repair the damage. Sabrina injects herself with three species of these synthetic organisms. We enter Sabrina's brain, where her neurons are under attack. All around us, a virus has ravaged her neural nuclei. The virus targets a healthy neuron. An antiviral nanite detects the intruder and moves to intercept it. In another part of her brain, Sabrina's protective myelin sheath needs rebuilding. Tens of thousands of axon repair nanites work together to repair the damage. A nanochip attracts misfiring neurons. The chip synchronizes for neural pulses. Thank you. same technology we used to build nanites lets us bring synthetic sentience to life. We are creating an avatar for Sabrina, a self-modifying, continually evolving, synthetic organism. As Sabrina and her avatar physical therapist practice Tai Chi, they are bonding, evolving, growing beyond their previous selves. Sabrina's new neural prosthetics have changed her perception of existence. Sabrina is no longer merely Sabrina.
Done about 2.5 years ago, and it was really based on a book that I'm in the process of authoring, actually, to kind of capture a few bits and pieces of a much larger sort of composite, bits and pieces of which I'm not going to try to explain today. But to kind of start with, I want to offer the reference point that there's a lot of things happening right now, biotechnology, infotechnology, nanotechnology, has kind of formed this what I call operational ecology. Even to this very moment, it seems like a theoretical world to many. I live in a different world. I live in a world where I communicate with venture capitalists, investors, people who have to plot strategy from an economic perspective. So I'm at the very hard edge of where the science and technology are actually being focused into policy and development as we speak. So pretty much what I'm going to be showing today is the truth of what currently is. I'm not defending it, I'm not saying it's right or wrong, I'm just saying it's what is. The whole point is you want to, hopefully, get a grasp as to what the elements of this transitional change are going to consist of. And I brought just a very small sampling of books and materials, which I'll explain as I give my talk. This one's Robert Friedis's Nanomedicine. It's probably the best compilation of papers published to date. This is the Evolvable Hardware Conference. I was there. This is the Department of Defense and JPL co-sponsored conference happens every year. This is the final version of the NNI, the National Nanotechnology Initiative, signed to law by the President of the United States. I served on one of the committees that made this possible. This is just one of several astrobiology publications coming out of NASA. And I'm going to show you a few other things, which will probably sound like science fiction, but I have to implore upon you, it's not science fiction. It's the reality of what's currently happening, how it fits into the framework of daily life, how it affects industry, how it affects what we do in the future is what I'm going to try to show today. And just as of yesterday, I just came from this conference, where this is kind of like a manual, a handbook, to teach the average person how to adjust to this nanotechnology. But on a more serious side, on the business side, I just came from this conference a few weeks ago. This is the advanced version of what's already been put into the business world. And to kind of give a framework of reference, this is the proceedings from GECKO. I've been to several of these over the years. This is the Genetic and Evolutionary Computing Conference proceedings. And this is Genetic Programming 97. I was there as well. Because when we talk about evolvable systems, self-evolving, self-organizing machines and software and networks, it's done. We're there now. So everything I'm going to try to show you, try to understand, this is the reality of where we're at this moment in time. So I like to use the term probing into the history of the future because as a futurist, that's what we do. We try to depict a histrionic of what's about to be. For anyone who's ever heard, say, James Burke give a talk or seen the Connection series, are people familiar with this? Where he kind of back entries about 3 centuries and ties together how different economic systems, political activities, and sort of accidental discoveries all sort of merge together to create this process that we now look at as part of our history. I do the very same thing, but I try to probe into the future in 5, 10, 20-year increments. And so the 4 major elements that I use to work out that framework is the combination of technology convergence, cultural morphology, economic drivers, and perhaps the most important of all, belief systems. Because belief systems is what defines the reality for the average person. It's what they see before them as their interpretation of the reality they're about to be confronted with. And whatever that perception might be or might not be, that in a sense is what determines policy. It's what determines what people will look towards as what they're going to respond to, whether they buy products or go to work in a certain way or vote for a candidate, whatever it might be. It's the belief system boundary point that gets transitioned into a different kind of belief system. That's what affects behavior. That's the core, really, of an anthropological system. And that's actually a very major component of what we're about to walk into, because if I were to define evolutionary process dynamics, that is, the elements that makes evolution perform the way it does, I would offer the three following points. A, evolution tends to be a trauma-induced process. Why do I say that? It sounds negative, but it's not. It's just the rules of nature. And it operates at all scales. It can be the individual person. It can be a collective. It could be a society. It could be an entire ecosystem. It operates in the psychological domain. It operates in the physical domain. Whatever the mechanism is that makes a person become different than what they were before, or an organization become different than what they were before, or a society, or a biophysical system with organisms, the same rules apply. They replicate like a fractal at all scales. And the overriding factor that is common throughout is, provided the periodicity and amplitude of the trauma cycles don't exceed the system's capacity to respond, it will tend to respond as a more robust function. But that's the whole point, that there is a kind of requirement almost for a test or a series of tests, pressure points, if you will, to drive the system to become different than what it had been before. Otherwise, it simply atrophies. And so I believe that right now, this moment, this particular moment in time, we're being presented with a test threshold of greater magnitude, greater complexity, and also higher velocity than all of the tests that we've had previously. So if I were to kind of plot this out in a more elaborate fashion, these are the major evolutionary event stream process dynamics and drivers that I see at this moment in time. We're living in a real-time, interconnected economic ecology. And what do I mean by that? Well, actually, has anybody ever heard of Michael Rothschild or the Bionomics Institute? Okay. I submitted a series of papers about 5 or 6 years ago that talked about the human internet symbiosis and biological systems as a model for looking at future development. From an economic perspective, Michael Rothschild wrote a very interesting book called The Economy as an Ecology. And in that book, he talks about biological processes mimicking what happens in an economic system. And in fact, it's quite remarkable how the two track together. And in fact, most of your economic theoreticians today use, guess what, ecological models to work out what they think the economy is going to be doing next. So there's a very specific kind of framework of reference to look at how nature operates and how economic systems operate. The two are very much tracked together. But what's interesting in today's world is that we're living in a real-time, interconnected world. The internet serves as a kind of a platform to facilitate this process. When you look at B2B systems, that is business-to-business systems, things that optimize what's called JIT capacity, just-in-time capacity, you're looking at very, very advanced forms of artificial intelligence and different kinds of biological metaphors in computing to optimize the supply chain, the value chain, the whole idea that from any point anywhere in the world you can see where all the different distribution points are and sort of optimize the operations. We are irreversibly connected to that world as we speak. Virtually every major business, I don't care what kind of a business it is, what their manufacturing, what their process consists of, they are now irreversibly tied to this real-time operational ecology to function. That's the point we're at this moment. The next point I'd like to bring up is the epicenters of value are indexed by what I call virtual commodity assets. What do I mean by that? The context here is that in times of yore, a nation state would say, our value is established by what our currency consists of, and our currency is based on hard assets, you know, bullion in the vault, or minerals in the ground, or timber, you know, whatever the thing is. I'm sorry? Okay. The point is that we're now living in a world where the physical hard assets are diminishing in value, because the processes that enable their production or their distribution actually has a higher value than the actual physical properties themselves. And where we're going with this is that nanotechnology, in its ultimate form, is the ability to manufacture things at the molecular scale to, in a sense, construct things, not by having to have a huge, centralized, megalithic, top-down manufacturing system that you have to distribute, but rather to have the actual production granular, everywhere where it might be interesting. And this is a very, very different model than virtually all the economic models that have happened before this. So we're looking at a kind of a transitional threshold that says many of these structures, these sort of bureaucratic systems that are wrapped around these highly centralized, megalithic, centralized manufacturing modalities, are about to be changed. And this could be highly disruptive. In fact, there's a term called disruptive technologies. I work in this arena all the time, and so a lot of my work has to do with explaining how to deal with the disruptive characteristics of this transition. Third, I'd like to point out this concept of the mass spawning of biological metaphors of computing. And again, when I hold up this kind of a book and say, well, it's being done, yes, it's being done. And what do I mean by this? Well, okay, think about this for a second. Let's think about routing systems, the internet. A lot of folks are concerned about pipe capacity, throughput to the user, how good is the interface. To me, that's all background noise. The real failure point that would indicate the health of the system is the routing engines. Because as the traffic keeps going up in density and complexity, we have to keep concentrating ever more on building these ever huger, gigantic sort of traffic management systems where you have tens of millions of lines of handwritten code instructing a whole bunch of computers, offering millions of switches, if you will, to determine where the traffic might be next, to do anticipatory analysis of how to best optimize this throughput capacity for this virtual commodity asset delivery system. Well, we're already at the failure point now. I mean, behind the scenes, there's a lot of panic going on. That's why Internet 2 is being developed as we speak. But the point is, people begin to realize that the old-fashioned way of having lots of coders writing code, doing a test, hoping it kind of works, maybe then on the fly they sort of work it out, that's fading away. What's coming around the corner is systems that evolve their own software, systems that evolve their own routing patterns, systems that, in fact, evolve their own hardware. Let me give you some examples. When I was at this conference right here, this JPL conference I showed you just a moment ago, this was last year, by the way. I was going to be at this year, except that I was like Echo instead. Some examples were indicated to kind of show how far this had come. Good example. Antenna design, and I used to work in microwave work for a while, is a very complex science. It's a combination of physics, material science, electromagnetic wave theory. I mean, it's a very far out kind of world to live in. And it's not simple. I mean, very few people can claim it especially. So in today's world, the pressure to design ever more complex functional antennas that can work in very strange environments in terms of temperature and different bandwidths and so on is a very, very pressing challenge. So at JPL, last year, they had a design that they had to fulfill. And they said, okay, here's our humans over here, our team as it were. Here's our evolutionary system over there. After about 4 weeks, the EC evolved in antenna design. Meanwhile, the humans were still sort of working on theirs. I saw this. But the humans eventually came up with this sort of Christmas tree-like structure. It was very nice, little branches and very orthogonal, the perfect kind of antenna, as it were. What the EC produced, or evolved, was a sort of ball with sort of twigs sticking out of it. Well, when they tested the antenna that was evolved, it not only worked better than the human version, nobody could explain why. That was like one example. In the world of evolved software, which has been done for several years now, and I know this is kind of a strange territory to wander into, because many people think of computing as like writing code and running in Windows or something like this. Well, what I'm trying to suggest to you is that the scale of complexity has gotten so extreme, especially in economic systems, that the mechanisms by which to model these highly complex systems goes far beyond the range of human coding. So today, as we speak, many of the economic systems models are not hand-coded at all. They're evolved. But the more interesting part, and this is where I'm going to lead up to a bit later, the number one industry where you find the biggest usage of biological metaphors in computing is, guess where? The biotech industry. Why would that be? The answer is as follows. We are a complex gadget. You know, this clumsy contraption, this biophysical thing called a body, it's a pretty complicated piece of machinery. And all living things are actually fairly complex. And yet we're at the horizon line of being able to decode genetically the inner workings of what makes these systems do what they do. We're at the molecular level of getting inside of cells and understanding how the organelles work. We're at the biophysical level of being able to sort of unravel and then sort of recombine the components of living things to make new kinds of living things. This is the most complex, challenging endeavor ever attempted in the history that we know of. It is the extreme outer frontier of complexity. There's nothing larger than we've ever tried. It makes the moon projects of the mid-50s tiny by comparison. And yet at the very heart of this operation, if you go to any of the big pharma companies, Amersham Pharmaceuticals, et cetera, I mean, I've been to all these places, private lid behind the scenes, like the Emerald City, what do you find? Guess what? Evolutionary computing. Because the only way to migrate through terabytes of data through hybridization experiments to do what's called in silico biology, where you actually model very complex physiological things, you can't do it by hand coding. It's not possible. The only way you get there is by using evolutionary computing as a process. And I'll explain this a little bit. In a really simple way, what evolutionary computing says is that you define the problem, you define a potential solution. You don't care how the solution is arrived. All you care about is if you allow the system to evolve over X number of iterations, it will strategize on its own its best possible solution to get to where that solution curve, as it's called, fits. It's called fitness curve matching. And when you have massively parallel reconfigurable computing platforms, and I'll go into that a bit later, where the system itself is soft, and therefore you can have this sort of operational ecology within the system, you can let it iterate millions, billions of times over. You can compress time. You can model an evolutionary event stream that might take millions of years and cram it down to a few hours. It's a very powerful tool. It's a tool that a lot of people in the outside world haven't seen quite yet, but they will. But behind the scenes, the biotech industry, economics, and a whole plethora of other worlds, aerospace being another one, where they're looking at how to come up with yet the next level of modeling, synthesis, and sort of peering into the virtual potential that might be, the only solution available, not as an option, but the only one available, is this biological metaphor of computing. And the reason I keep harping on this is because think about this. There's a perfect loop here. Here we are as a biophysical system, as a biological entity, using virtual biology to construct what we're about to evolve into. It's a very interesting loop. So the first topic I want to get into is this irreversible human internet symbiosis threshold. We're already there. In fact, my first paper on this was published in 1995 in Vienna, strangely enough, at the European Symposium on Cybernetics and Artificial Intelligence. And why I bring that up is only because back then, a bunch of folks, Francis Haugen, who founded something called the Global Brain Society, started talking about this concept of emergent sentience, emergent intelligence, where you have this vast collection of network systems that communicate to each other without human intervention. In fact, the whole idea of looking at the internet as a kind of like a living ecology, where you have viruses and you have a sort of like an antigen response to purge the viruses, and you have self-correcting systems, self-organizing routing engines, you have intelligent agents and autonomous agents and colonies of agents that are sort of migrating through the system to reconstruct knowledge ontologies on the fly. But every unit of measure that one can define a biological model, guess what? The internet has become that biological model. And so if you walk down this trail a little bit further and suggest that the vast majority of the world's industries now rely exclusively on the internet, not to sell things. I'm not talking about web pages and blinking banner ads. Forget that. That's nonsense. That's background noise. What I'm trying to suggest is that the core of what makes their manufacturing, their distribution, their supply chain and value chain management possible is irreversibly hooked, connected, enmeshed, if you will, inside this biological system that we currently call the internet. In fact, I just finished working on a book that's going to be talking about the future of the internet as a living thing. I can't tell you the time I'm allowed to, but it comes out in about 4 months. And the point is that even the people of the inside, the Intel types and all the people in the CEOs and major corporations, they are now, well, I'm going to say gleefully, but they're admitting that they're kind of drawn into this irreversible realm. And there's a lot of talk behind the scenes, but the whole point is that the very thing that makes us tick as an economy, the functioning entity, is irreversibly reliant upon this virtual world. You can't see it, you can't touch it, but it's everywhere. It's ubiquitous. And we are now organisms attached to this other ecology. So the fifth point I want to bring up is the inception of the molecular manipulation value chain. What do I mean by this? Think about this for a moment. Right now we're looking at things like energy systems, manufacturing systems, distribution systems that are huge, top-down, megalithic infrastructure systems that require vast investments. Billions of dollars have to be put up front to build the factory or the power plant or the chip manufacturing foundry, whatever it might happen to be. This model is at the edge of what I might call irreversible failure mode. And there's a series of reasons for this. We have, for a long time, for all the millennia that we know about, in this addicted to a kind of a predatory industrial process-based mechanism that says that the only way we can exist as a functioning entity is to glomp onto somebody else's territory, dig minerals out of the ground, you know, pump oil out of the ground, or you know, clear cut a forest and take all the trees away, whatever it happens to be. The planet is designed to support life up to a certain length of time. We've been around here for about 2.5 million years that we know about. Up to that time, we've had the luxury, if you will, of being able to be that predatory and also kind of sloppy, if you will, in our industrial processes. But we're kind of hitting a threshold point. 10 years, 20 years, you can draw a chart in line if you wish, but the whole point is, at a certain threshold, we're not going to be allowed that luxury anymore. That the cost on quality of life, on the ability to function, on the ability to even continue to exist in our current framework, is going to be very severely tested, because we can no longer, there's no new territory to conquer. There's no new stuff to sort of glomp onto. We're sort of digesting everything at an ever-increasing rate. So it doesn't sort of suggest that maybe an alternative mechanism might be brought into place that would allow us a different kind of way of producing the things that we need to live and function with. And I'm going to go into nanotechnology in much more detail, but I just kind of want to suggest that as a kind of a start point, because otherwise it doesn't quite make sense. But nanotechnology, in my opinion, is really, it's like a coin being flipped up in the air. Is it dangerous? Yes. Can it be badly abused? Of course. But also, is it a ticket to a different way of existing that frees us from the kind of predatory process we're now addicted to? Yes, it does. I'm sorry, we have a strange noise. I'm not sure what that is. Oh, I'm sorry. I felt like a jet was flying into the building or something. I wasn't sure what that was. 9/11, well, okay. Well, geez. So, on that note, I'll have some biology here. Over-emergent, thank you very much. Okay, there we go. So, and by the way, this is not a formal talk. I mean, I invite anyone that wants to toss out a comment, ask a question, please. My purpose today is to, well, have fun, but obviously to deliver what I think is an important message. So feel free to offer your comments if you wish. So the next point is what I call emergent sovereign knowledge domains. What do I mean by this? I would suggest to you, think about Gutenberg's press. What was Gutenberg's press really? It was a printing machine, of course, obviously, but it was something more important. Think of back in the time in Europe, Middle Ages, where the window of truth, the multimedia of its day, as it were, was stained glass embedded in a cathedral wall. The average person who lived the life of a serf, their only privilege to knowledge was through these stained glass windows. And usually under pain of death, and usually a rather unpleasant death, if they deviated from that path of truth, terrible circumstances were at hand. Suddenly Gutenberg's press appears. Books flourished almost overnight. Even on horseback and by foot, within a handful of years, knowledge was spreading like wildfire. It was like a meme. It had a spectacular effect on the culture of its time. And just in your mental framework, think about the concept of the Library of Alexandria in ancient times, representing all of the known knowledge of the world at that time. So think of the idea of Gutenberg's press meets the Library of Alexandria, multiplied by a trillion or more, and thrust into a real-time, interconnected knowledge environment. That's what we have today. That's what the internet sort of facilitates in a way. But think of the potential of what this represents in the fact that you now have self-evolving knowledge ontologies. That is, different kinds of knowledge are sort of self-organizing and sort of reconstructing based on the human layer sort of attached to this sort of realm. And in terms of complexity management, once again, the most complex undertaking on Earth at this moment in time is the biotech industry. Because here you have people from many, many different scientific disciplines, from backgrounds as diverse as you can possibly imagine, suddenly sort of coming together to invent the stuff of life on a contiguous basis. And the only thing that makes that possible is not the traditional world of I specialize in X and here's the collection of books I've read and here's the thing I've studied. No. It's the potential of having this very fluid-like knowledge domain that's constantly sort of morphing and changing. And from whatever perspective a person's interest might be, they can probe into that knowledge domain and pull out the things they're looking for. How does that actually work? Guess what? Evolutionary computing, artificial life, biological metaphors, and computing. It is the core of what makes that self-evolving knowledge ontology possible. So kind of in a strange way, Gutenberg's press, Library of Alexandria, multiplied by a trillion, thrust into a real-time operational ecology that itself is like a life form. That's the point I was hoping to make. So the next thing I wanted to come up with is this idea of the dissolution of the organic synthetic domain boundaries. And what does that really mean? Organic, you know, this living thing, organic? Okay, fine. A lot of people right now are panicking because they hear things like genetically modified foods. Oh my God, help, please, that's that. Well, slow down, wait a minute, hold on. You know, we've been genetically modifying food for centuries, thousands of years actually. People breed cattle and they sort of carefully control how they breed. People cross strains of different kinds of vegetables to get a better strain of vegetables. Okay, fine. That's kind of the clumsy Rube Goldberg way to go about it. Now we have the tools that says we can model down to the molecular level how those biological things work. We can transfect, and that's the word for it. We can use different kinds of organisms as a carrier to grow the stuff that we'd otherwise have to manufacture. Think about drugs for a minute. Medicine itself is a huge topic, and I won't go into it too much today, but this was a kind of an overview. In today's world, the procedure is you come down to pathology, you go into the hospital or medical provider, whatever, they look at what's going on, they take some tests, they send the samples off to the lab, and a few days later the samples come back, and they think they may or may not know what's wrong. And then eventually they start prescribing drugs. And the drugs are basically chemistry systems which are designed to, in a sense, counteract whatever the pathology might be consisting of. But more often than not, the drugs are kind of messy, if you will. After all, the entire body gets sort of exposed to it. And then you have to take more drugs to counteract the side effects of the first set of drugs, and then you have to take more drugs to counteract those side effects, and so on. So the whole thing becomes kind of a giant mess. Let's try something different. Let's instead say that because we can now have your entire genome mapped out, and we know precisely what physiological mechanisms are peculiar just to you, we can use what is called proteomic pharmacology to target precisely those cells and only those cells which need to be modified to have their internal behavior sort of changed to a better form. Let's take it a step further. Let's say that we can now genetically modify a vegetable that doesn't require pesticides, that uses less water, that contains more vitamins, that can be grown in a third world country where it couldn't be grown before. I mean, you sort of see where I'm going with this. In other words, a lot of people panic when they hear these terms and they think, oh my gosh, we're deviating from nature. Well, wait a minute. Maybe this is nature. In other words, if we've been here for 2.5 million years and we've gone through all these trials and tribulations and war and pestilence and predatory behaviors and all the nonsense that other organisms probably go through in other worlds as well, and now we're finally here, isn't it actually part of nature that we simply have a better set of tools? And isn't it interesting that we use the rules of nature to create the tools that we're now using to modify the nature around us? So before you throw away the baby with the bathwater, I'm not defending anything necessarily, but I'm just saying, examine this more carefully. Consider what these tools really consist of. Consider that we have right before us the sort of palette, like a painter has with different paints on it. How we use the palette is the test. That is what we're confronted with, not the tools themselves. The tools are fine. It's, are we spiritually mature enough to understand what to do with them? And that's what I'm going to try to lean on a little bit later in this presentation. It leads up to this last point, hybrid forms of consciousness, access to the quantum foam. This is the point I'm sort of leaning towards, and it's a little bit over the edge perhaps for some, but I want to offer the idea that for thousands of years, us human beings, us Homo sapiens, have pondered our own existence. Virtually every culture on Earth, if you strip away the surface veneer of language and ritual and so on, the same core truth emerges ubiquitously. A sense of interconnectedness, a sense that all living things are somehow, if you want to use the word, empathically connected. That we have the power to transcend this sort of four-dimensional framework here, and we have sort of another framework that's often referred to as the quantum domain. I believe this to be true. Furthermore, I believe that the physical hard science evidence to support this is also coming to light very quickly. And the tools by which to measure that sort of quantum access are also coming to life. There's a bunch of projects going on, some of which I won't tell you about because I'm not allowed to, but let's just say the world of quantum computing, quantum encryption, nanoscale devices designed to operate in the quantum world, this is all being done. A lot of it's being planned for DARPA, by the way, but I just say, believe me when I tell you, the stuff that makes this sort of thing possible is sort of around the corner. So as the next increment of our evolutionary event stream, we suddenly have this sort of nanotech, biotech, infotech trichotomy, as it were, here in our lap. We're figuring out what to do with it. But right around the corner is this sort of next realm that says that can we, at will, or under certain conditions, connect to this quantum realm? So like an empathic web sort of waiting for us to connect to. Well, I want to try an experiment or just an idea. Think of it like this. If you go backwards in time, like I said, all these different cultures sort of saw and felt the same thing. They could tell presence. You know, I grew up in a farming town where we had horses and cows and things. I could walk up to a horse within 50 feet, the horse knew I was there, and it would turn around and look at me. It would kind of sense that I had, you know, the frame of mind, as it were, and I was usually friendly. At Lawrence Laboratory, back in the mid-70s, we were researching earthquakes. We were collecting data from all over the world. People's Republic of China, former Soviet bloc, everywhere you can imagine. What was interesting was the thousands, tens of thousands of anvil references to animals that could sense something was about to happen days before it happened. I mean, it was unbelievable how consistent the data was. We tried everything. We tried radon measurement to see if there was gas being frozen on the ground. We tried electromagnetic measurements. We tried looking for piezoelectric effect, rocks being frozen, they don't give on current, that kind of thing. We looked at every, you know, ultra-low frequency sound, all the usual stuff that a science guy would think about. None of it worked. Zero. It was, at that point, this is 75, I'm thinking, you know, what are animals tuning in on that we're not quite getting here? And now let's take a different approach. Like I said, you look at any indigenous culture from anywhere on the planet, any continent, I don't care what their race or color, strip it all away, same thing emerges. This sense of presence, the sense of the sort of biological life force, this idea that we empathically interconnect to the things around us. Okay, that might sound like philosophy, but let's try a different look. There's been work going on at Princeton University, SRI, a lot of other places that have been looking at sort of how to measure the effects of collective consciousness when it occurs, what I call mental synchronicity on a mass scale. And for a number of years, a process called RNG, random regeneration, has been used to kind of determine the spikes of the pokes out of the cat after race war, caused by about a whole bunch of people who are sort of thinking or focusing the same thing at once. And this kind of experiment's been done for years and years. It's been published all over the world. Like I said, for the Soviet bloc, did a lot of work, so great, et cetera. To the point where it became actually a military enterprise, and none of us have been working at SRI under the auspices of the U.S. military, because they felt that they could do things like remote viewing and other things that involve sort of precognition of various events and so on, to the point where it became a definable military protocol. But back then, the tools were kind of crude, and the practice that was required to get to a certain level of being able to use a sort of empathic interaction took months, actually years of training. It was a very precise kind of process that they went through. Meanwhile, around the world, in other parts of the planet, I mean, you have Tibetan monks that would spend their entire lifetime and they could eventually get this sort of state of mind where they could truly probe this empathic realm. You have all different cultures that would sort of have specialized rituals designed to get the person to a physiological framework so that their state of mind could sort of track in the same way. But what's happening now is now all of a sudden we have the nanobiological and biophysical modalities to really understand what happens in here and also potentially what replicates in the quantum domain. We're about to open this Pandora's box as a functional instrument of sorts. This could be very dangerous. It could also be the most powerful thing we've ever had access to. How many people in here have ever seen a movie called Forbidden Planet? Does that sound familiar? A couple of folks. Okay, good. For those that haven't, let me give you an example. This came out in 1961. Now, a lot of people think of Forbidden Planet, they think of Robbie the Robot and all this sort of fluffy stuff. Remove that. The focus is this. You had this mythical civilization called the Krell. Krell had gone a few million years past where we are now, evolutionary system. Fine. They got to a point that said, you know, we have the capacity for an infinite energy supply. They were using a fusion engine as the example. We also have the capacity for a mind-machine interface. We feel that the solution to our socio-anthropological shortcomings as a species is to do the following. To allow anyone to have anything they want at the moment of inception, they can just think it and it appears and they have it. This would cause freedom from want, it would end all warfare, all forms of greed and avarice, all the predatory behaviors. This is the technical solution. Let's go for it. So in a single fortnight, all the Krell, they strapped on their gear, they thought of the things they wanted to have and they thought they were going to have all this lovely stuff. But you know what killed them? This is the spike coming out of the noise floor. Monsters from the Id. That was the most seminal marker point in the film. Monsters from the Id. In other words, they had their own internal demons that they hadn't quite worked out yet. And their internal demons, interesting enough, manifest in the form of all kinds of horrible creatures and gargoyles and killed everybody instantly. So, when I talk about things like the spiritual health index of a species, I mean it in a very literal sense. And in fact, I'm going to show a chart here in just a few slides, but the theory is we have a technical health index, which is almost like a vertical line, because again, we have this sort of infotech, nanotech, biotech trichotomy driving this almost blindingly accelerated pace of development. But I would submit to you that our spiritual health index is sort of down here. That's the challenge. If we're to survive this next evolutionary test, if we are to step across this irreversible event horizon, that, in my opinion, is where we should be focusing. And so when I talk about this hybrid forms of consciousness and access to quantum foam, that's what I'm trying to suggest. So, you look at the Industrial Revolution, the next volume. Well, guess what? The same rules apply, because what do we have? We have technology convergence, cultural morphology, economic drivers, and most importantly, belief systems. Whoops, I'm not sure what happened there. Think of it like this. I've got a lot of friends out there in the industry world, people at Intel, for instance. These guys are panicking. They know that in 18 months, Moore's second law is about to kill their industry, basically. Anybody familiar with Moore's second law? Well, I mean, I'll just explain it in general. Economies of scale is sort of a little science in and of itself. And in analyzing what's called economies of scale, you have to figure out, to get to the next scale of complexity, whatever it is you're manufacturing, it takes a certain loss leader investment. Right now, you look at the current state of ULSI, ultra large-scale integration and chip manufacture, the cost of the next scale of fabrication capacity is about between $2.5 to $5 billion. Well, the reality is that you cannot possibly sell enough computer chips with an ever-diminishing LBO, lifetime before obsolescence, to an ever-diminishing market. It just doesn't work. The numbers, you know, it's like lines on a chart. They cross it, there's a failure point. Okay, fine. So even if the rules of physics of Moore's first law says you could probably go for another 6 years or something, forget it. In 2 years max, it's not going to work as an economic system. Well, there's a lot of folks in Intel right now who have been there for 25, 30 years, very smart guys. These are all nice folks. But they don't want to see this. They're scared. They like life just the way it is. Make more chips, Pentium 5 around the corner, whatever. That's all they know. That's all they want to know. They don't want to suddenly have to learn about 10 different other sciences simultaneously and have to sort of reorient their entire economic system from a cultural perspective. And that's one small example of a whole bunch of industries. Like the drug industry is like another example, very similar to parallel. So the whole idea of belief systems having to be reorganized in a certain way, the whole idea of a cultural morphology that kind of breaks away from the large, orthogonal, centralized, bureaucratic mechanism by which these energies can be facilitated, this is a huge challenge. This is a big deal. This is as much as believing in God, almost, in some cases. So when I use these 4 points, I mean them quite literally. So I talked about the emergent infotech, biotech, and nanotech trichotomy. This actually is not my slide. This actually came from, where is it? Here. Well, I lost it. I'm being disorganized, so here we go. And you can actually go online now and look at this document. Now, I actually have the much larger version of this document because I worked on one of the committees. But think about this. Here you have a whole bunch of different government agencies, all of whom have been sort of trained under the dogma of being self-contained, competitive, secretive. Cooperation amongst the agencies was not known to be a natural art form in the culture. And within these domains, you had departments and department chairs and people who compete for grants and this whole idea of this is my little thing and I'm going to protect it. Almost overnight, as a government policy, the edict went out and said, no, this isn't going to work. You're going to have to completely reverse this entire trend, this entire way of doing things. Let me give you a little history. 2.5 years ago, at Loyola College in Maryland, which is a well-known policy school, it was very quietly held, but there was the International Symposium on Strategic Nanoscale Technologies. And we invited all kinds of folks, people from all over the world. Anyone who wanted to come was welcome to. The reason being, they wanted to get like a snapshot of what the world was doing in terms of nanoscale systems and development and manufacturing and so on. So all kinds of things showed up. We were kind of surprised, actually, how far things had gone. But the whole point was we wanted to establish some kind of a framework, a reference, so that we could develop a national policy. We realized that something this large and this complex had to have some kind of centralized realm from which we could determine where investments should go, where what areas of science deserve most attention, and so on. So the following year, we had the responses, the National Strategic Nanoscale Technology Symposium, again at Loyola College. And at that point, the decision was made that says, look, not only do we have this incredibly broad spectrum of different scientific disciplines, which all sort of interconnect, we have to invent a new kind of culture to make this possible. So when you actually go online and look at the published version of this, and there's a lot of stuff that isn't published because it's military and so on, but the published version, the first thing you see, the first paragraph says, we're approaching a new, you know, bureaucratic realm. They don't use that word, but that's the essence of it. What we have to really instigate now, a sense of partnering, alliance formation, interdisciplinary cooperation amongst all these different departments. I mean, for a government agency to have that as their first introduction, it kind of suggests a change in the cultural morphology, which you'll be seeing replicated in many different realms. So when I talk about the operational ecology, it's a translation to a virtual form of nature. And I mean this quite literally, because once again, we're looking at self-evolving information architectures, process platforms, knowledge ontologies. These are self-constructing systems. We drive the stimulus mechanisms, but we also feed off of what comes out the other end. At the same time, from a sort of a hardware perspective, we have, guess what? Self-assembling, self-organizing molecular systems, biological and non-biological. And that's where we're at this moment in time. How many folks are familiar with Bill Joy? Okay. Bill Joy published a now rather famous or perhaps infamous article, depends on your perspective. Came out in Wired magazine about a year and a half ago. Now, I've talked to Bill Joy many times, and I have great respect for him. He's very intelligent, very thoughtful. He's co-founder of Sun Microsystems. I mean, a very decent individual. I'm no way impugning him at all, but I don't necessarily believe what he says. And so let me defend that. Because he wrote this article in Wired where he talks about the sort of infotech, nanotech, biotech world, and artificial intelligence and artificial life and all in this kind of dark framework. Like, this is this huge, foreboding black thing that's going to invade the world, and we're all going to turn into gray goo. Well, not exactly. And I respect that he's trying to draw attention to the idea. In fact, 2 weeks later, I went on the air myself into national radio and spent 4 hours explaining what Bill Joy was trying to talk about. And then, of course, just a few months ago, last June, or this June of this year, they had sort of a revisit and at Stanford. And they had these events there over the last few months where they bring in all the different sort of leading specialists from these different worlds to sort of revisit the subject matter to see where this operational ecology is heading towards. And so last June, I was there and had a long chat with Bill Joy. And I asked him, I said, you know, I understand that you probably have successfully woken up a portion of the population to kind of get them in this mode, but is using the panic driver the right way to approach this? And he kind of thought about that kind of carefully and gave me sort of an interesting answer. But the point is, this is not, we're not going to put this back in the box. The box is already open. It's here. And we're not going to, like, sort of hide and make it sort of go away. Sorry, it doesn't work that way. The tools are at hand. And so what I'm trying to suggest to you is that the tools could offer a very interesting collection of solutions to an otherwise horrific, unsolvable problems. And that's the framework I'm going to try to introduce. So one of the things I sort of came up with actually a while ago, this is from an earlier paper, is this whole idea of an existence evaluation system architecture. In other words, as a joke, I once said, well, you know, at some point in time, existence is going to be measured on a moment-to-moment basis. You're going to wear like a watch device that tells you how much it costs to exist on a second-by-second basis. I was actually at the Ubiquitous Computing Forum. I was giving a lecture at the time. And one of the folks in the audience, a guy I've known for many years named Jim Hurd, he said, well, you know, Charles, at a certain point, you're going to have biochip implants in your brain. They're going to measure your consciousness on a contiguous basis, and you're going to get micropayments based on what you're focusing on at a given point in time. And you might be working for X number of entities simultaneously from around the world, you know, via the sort of empathic net thing. And I said, yeah, okay, probably 10 years ago, something like that. Well, as it turns out, of course, today, there's a company in Florida which actually manufactures a biochip implant, which is designed to track prisoners and mental patients and people with other complexities going on, based on the Air Force project along the same line several years ago. The whole plan is to be able to track down pilots in difficult areas. So, like, there's stuff already sort of hovering on the horizon that says, well, actually, the piece of the puzzle is sort of there. Will it get put into practice as better policy? Well, maybe, but in other words, the pieces are sort of hovering. So if I were to take this just a step further, just like an imaginary kind of thing, think about this. You have basically three basic layers. The three layers go as follows. You have a transaction layer. What do I mean by this? Well, about a year ago, there was an ad that came out on TV. It was kind of funny because it only appeared a few times and it was taken off the air. It was IBM. I don't know how many folks saw this, but the ad went as follows. A guy walks in the store. He's picking up things off the shelf, puts them in his coat. He walks out the door. And then all of a sudden, the security guard rushes after him, thinking he's going to get arrested or something. Oh, he forgot your receipt. The whole point was the store knew it was him. The items he picked up could transact instantaneously and go into his electronic debit system. No credit cards, no currency, nothing. It was just all instantaneous. That's an ergonomic interface at the four-dimensional, instantaneous, sort of contextual cognition layer. Right now, we still have to carry a card around, plug into a machine, type in some numbers and all that nonsense. But a whole bunch of folks are trying really hard to sort of get that going away. They're steering much more towards a sort of JIT transaction layer that says that you don't have to care anything. It's just biometric presence detection can tell it's you, and whatever you touch or interact with, instantaneously, it goes into the ubiquitous data grid and the transaction occurs. So we're sort of almost there as we speak. So you have process inception, which means the minute I pick this up, something out there knows about it. We have an ergonomic interface, which is this, as opposed to a machine with a screen. So the next thing that goes in is what I call the existence template, i.e., a ubiquitous data grid that any time something occurs involving your presence, it's updated contiguously, all the time, simultaneously. And the stuff of that realm already exists. It's just a matter of sort of organizing to a higher degree of efficiency. So at that same timeline, if you will call it, or process threshold, you also have this data brokerage. And now think about this for a moment. Right now, you have a whole bunch of different pieces of information. By the way, in 1998, Time Magazine had in their centerfold article, and I should have brought it in there, and they talked about the sort of national ID card also being your transaction card, also being your healthcare card. And they were trying to like sell it to the public as sort of a pleasant thing, like this is going to make your life more efficient, and why deal with physical currency when this is a much better way to go, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, you know, the IRS loves this idea, so do the banks, as you can well imagine. And so do most business entities who want to optimize the ability to track and measure to see what you're doing out there so they can kind of tailor their marketing strategy and so on. I mean, today you go to Safeway, you have to have a Safeway card, you go to the machine so they can sell you stuff and they track what you've been doing in the store. You have your credit card which tracks all of your financial information. Then, of course, right around the corner you're going to be having your sort of biological information set that also tracks along with you. So is it really that far away where you have everything centralized into a single smart card entity that whatever process you're engaging in, the whole data grid sort of knows about it and does a modification accordingly? Yeah, we're pretty close.